Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and we got a really exciting guest in store for you today. I think you're really going to enjoy this podcast. He is the author and producer and creator of a wonderful DVD. I found it absolutely riveting. It has a very modest title. It's called The Perfect Human Diet. And so, what is the perfect human diet? Well, all of us have been in quest of the perfect human diet. And my guest today has undertaken a personal quest for the perfect human diet. And he's going to share with us how he came upon it. He has a very interesting history. He is CJ Hunt. He's a broadcast journalist. He's a producer and host with over 20 years in broadcasting and TV. And he's the author of two books on diet and health. And he's got a very interesting story, a personal story, which led him to the discovery of what he terms the perfect human diet. So without further ado, let's hear from you, CJ. It's nice having you on Intelligent Medicine.
Thanks so much, Doctor. I really appreciate your invitation.
Okay, well, give us, because this has been a personal interest of yours. You have been on a quest over several decades to determine what works best for you, with the inference that this may have widespread applicability to people in general. You've done a lot of research, but you had a very compelling personal reason for seeking out the perfect human diet. So share that with us.
Oh, yes. When I was 24, I was a dirt bike motocross racer. And I went jogging one day at Beverly Hills High School, went a lap and a half, and dropped dead.
You went to Beverly Hills High School?
No, I just lived in the area, and that was the local track.
Okay, funny, because I'm actually from that neck of the woods. I'm from Santa Monica, California, so we were near neighbors.
There you go.
Okay.
There you go. So, yeah, I just happened to be on Memorial Day 1978. I went out for a jog with a friend because he wanted to, you know how far he was running. And like I said, I went a lap and a half, and I went down. Luckily enough, an anesthesiologist had shown up to go jogging about the same time and got to me in the first 3 to 4 minutes and started giving me CPR. And the Beverly Hills paramedics responded, and they transported me to UCLA Medical Center, where I spent 10 days in intensive care. So it was quite a wake-up call at 24, you know, to find yourself all of a sudden in the dirt, you know, and that if it wasn't for these really wonderful efforts, I wouldn't have been rescued.
Well, did they determine what the cause of it was? Did you have an arrhythmia, or did you have a heart attack? You know, did they ever determine why it was that at such a young age you were susceptible to this kind of heart problem?
Well, at the time, they weren't really able to pin it down 100%, except that they finally determined that I had a heart birth defect, which at the time they called idiopathic hypertrophic subaortic stenosis.
Okay, so that's for a listening audience, you know, since I'm an MD, I'll define that. That is a potentially dangerous enlargement of a part of the heart called the ventricle. It just keeps getting bigger and bigger and thicker until it becomes ineffectual, unable to pump blood. And that actually, you know, that actually may be the cause of some of these tragic deaths that we see of some of the young basketball players and athletes. Out of the blue, they seem to drop dead during a basketball game. And that's one of the reasons they call for screening of young athletes, more aggressive screening with whatever, you know, EKGs or perhaps echocardiograms to make sure that they can take it. Anyway, so you at a very young age, you recognized your vulnerability. You had intimations of mortality, and that got your attention big time.
Oh, yeah, very much. And so I started doing whatever I could to find out about how to take care of myself. I mean, particularly since I was still wanted to remain athletic at the time, the folks at UCLA, I couldn't stay in the medically supervised programs because they didn't want me being quite so aggressive in my own care. They were worried if I went down once, there was over a 50% chance of me dying in the next 2 years anyway. And so my mom came up from San Diego and followed me in the car when I would go jogging.
Wow.
Yeah, and it was before cell phones. So
that's got to be psychologically daunting.
Oh, yeah, it was a big deal. But then I was so interested in health and well-being, I started, you know, reading everything that was available at the time. And, of course, in Hollywood, they had a famous store there called the Bodhi Tree, which is filled with health information and metaphysical information and whatnot. So it was everything from raw foodists to vegetarianism to macrobiotics and all these different belief systems and theories about how you could remain healthy. And I tried just about all of them.
And this sounds like this may have been in the 70s or the 80s.
Correct. Yeah. My cardiac arrest was in 1978.
Okay. So clearly that was a period of time, and I remember that time very well, where vegetarian diet, macrobiotic diet was very much in vogue, and particularly in Southern California, raw foods diet, you know, sprouting and so on. That was, you know, for someone who had a heart problem, I guess that was something you may have naturally gravitated towards.
Yes, it was in vogue, and it was very popular, and you know, there was kind of a pushback against Western medicine at the time and feeling that they didn't really have it all figured out, so why not try these alternative ideas? And so, like so many people, I did. And eventually ended up being a raw food vegan for about 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, for the most part, I felt okay. I still was active. I, you know, taught how to, you know, feed myself and keep going. And although I did get very thin, I was down to about 162, and my average is 182.
How tall are you?
I'm 6 foot, 1/2 inch.
Okay, so that's a little bit maybe on the emaciated side.
A little bit there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I pursued those things, and then eventually I found out that some of life's impacts, it didn't serve me well. My mother got killed by a drunk driver. There was so much stress and emotional trauma going on at the time, I just couldn't bounce back. And there was a little inner voice that started calling out, you know, said, eat fish. Mm-hmm. You know, get some protein in there, because all I ate was fruits, vegetables, nuts, seeds, and sprouts at the time.
Right. Wow. Okay.
Yes.
So you started moving more towards a moderate a pesco vegetarian diet, and so what piqued your interest in other dietary approaches?
Well, at the same time that I was going through this experimentation, I was developing professionally, and I ended up going into broadcast news as a reporter, anchor reporter, and so I was also very interested in following the health stories of the day. And for a long time, you know, the obesity epidemic has been growing. It's getting worse. Chronic disease has been getting worse. Yet we kept turning back to the same supposed solutions to try to find an answer. And it seemed like nobody was willing to look outside the box to find something new. And so that's created a whole another level of curiosity for me.
And of course, this was the time where all the low fat and low cholesterol foods began to appear in the markets, and people began to look at butter and fat and eggs as being harmful. That's, I think, when they started to develop egg substitutes. You know, things like, you know, what do they call them? The egg beaters.
Oh, yes, the egg beaters.
And that was the environment that you were, you know, beginning to explore. And, of course, you had a heart problem, so you figured, you know, I better keep my cholesterol low because that's what's going to give me a heart attack ultimately, and, you know, I don't want to hasten my demise.
Well, exactly. And, you know, if all you see is this same information of the low-fat diet and eventually the food pyramid that gave those guidelines. And I think that we're very trusting to begin with. If we see it all the time and every media source is saying that and every magazine and book is saying that is popular, and that anytime anyone brings up an alternative idea, whether it be at that time back then, it was people like Atkins and whatnot, they were vilified. So more and more you kept trying, I think, try to keep your nose to the grindstone and stick it out, that if you did it, just kept doing it and did it long enough, then you would find some kind of positive result. But that wasn't the case. I was just hungry all the time.
Right. Did your condition get worse, or were you told of high cholesterol or any other risk factors at that point?
Yeah, no, I never had any of the blood tests that indicated that it was a problem. It all seemed to harken back to my, you know, birth defect, and
right.
And I managed to stay within the norms all along. I didn't really start having more heart problems until 20 years later. So now I have a pacemaker, defibrillator as a backup,
mm-hmm.
And that's also what drove me to expand my professional curiosity and go back to school and learn how to do film and television and pursue these ideas that I'd heard about or read a little bit about, like there was a snippet in the original Protein Power by Michael Eads, and I'd seen a couple of newspaper articles on Loren Cordain and some of his work with Paleolithic nutrition before he wrote a book and before it was popular, and thought, well, this is interesting. You know, if there's, why don't we go out and start looking for ourselves to see if these things are in fact true? And, you know, that's what started that whole path that eventually led to the DVD and the film.
Well, you interview a wide variety of experts in the film, and what I appreciate about the film is that it's not just propaganda. You're talking to reputable scientists, you're talking to experts in the field of nutrition. Andrew Weil is one of the individuals that you managed to recruit to talk about diet in the film, and also Loren Cordain and some of the top people, Barry Sears, who have looked at the relationship between carbohydrates and insulin resistance and the balance of essential fatty acids in our diets, and also the anthropology of, you know, what it is that makes us human and our natural predilections in terms of what we should be eating. Now, one of the most interesting sequences I found visually in the movie, and, you know, we can talk about this ad nauseum, but a picture is worth a thousand words, right? Because there's a great sequence. You really, really captured it in the movie. I think it's with Loren Cordain, where you went to the University of Colorado, where he, you know, I guess he's a professor out there, and you got on the football field, and you walked the football field. And can you share with our listeners, try and give them a verbal painting of what that sequence depicts?
Well, sure. These new experts that are looking at the anthropology of it talk about human evolution, and the only thing I had ever seen before was a paper rolled across a library that had marks on it that, you know, to tell you, well, this represented 2.5 million years of human evolution, but that people can't really relate to that. So we're trying to think of, well, what would be on a scale of something that everybody's familiar with so they could understand this idea of human evolution. And it turns out to be a football field. Everyone recognizes that. So we started at one end at the beginning of human evolution about 2 million years ago. The beginning of modern human evolution.
Right.
And walked up the field and stopped at various points along the field to talk about the changes that were happening because of our dietary changes. And you're right, and I get that same feedback that really makes it come to life and make sense to people then when they can see it in that kind of an environment and on that scale. And it worked out really nicely to illustrate that. We walk all the way down the field, and then when we get up to modern foods, we're down to the half-yard line, and then we get up to modern junk foods, it's the width of a blade of grass. It's the last one-fifth of 1 inch. So when you sit at the other end of the football field and you look all the way back and you say, well, wait a second, humans are eating now until the width of a blade of grass. It's no wonder we're having problems, as Loren would say. And it does. It helps people kind of take a moment and go, well, that's a light bulb moment. That's one of those, I don't know, I don't remember what Oprah would call them, that you really get a realization that we're way off track.
Indeed. And so let's look at some of the anthropological evidence that you managed to gather, because you actually went to some sites where they were gathering human fossils. And typically when you look at human fossils, you look at where they find human fossils. You find human fossils in relationship to the evidence of what people ate, because they were, you know, people have, you know, just like we have modern landfills where cavemen or our ancestors used to live, they used to discard scraps of the foods that they didn't consume. So what does that evidence show us?
Well, and that's an excellent, you know, representation, you know, the old garbage yards. What happened is I went and saw Loren, like you said, on the football field, and at the end of that conversation, when the cameras were off, he said, you know, you need to go talk to Mike Richard at the Max Planck Institute in Leipzig, Germany, because they've developed new technology that can tell us exactly what humans ate, you know, throughout as much of time that they have bones to look at.
And so, some of it's by analyzing fossils of stool, and some of it's by looking at patterns on teeth and, you know, all kinds of amazing techniques.
Yes, there's a wide range and different scientists that are looking at all these little things and trying to bring all that information together to give us, you know, solid answers as far as what humans are designed to eat or what they ate over evolution as they evolved. And what was really fascinating about this is Mike says, well, on the way here, stop in the south of France. We've got a dig going on from beginning to end. You see us, you can see the dig site. You can talk to the head of our department there, Jean-Jacques Houblon, who was present, and other anthropologists, and you know, look at the whole process. See them digging up the animal bones, the human bones, the Neanderthal bones, and then follow that trail back to Leipzig, and they could tell us about the analysis. And that was completely unexpected. I didn't anticipate that at all when we started it out, and it turns out to be the amazing revelation of the film, I think.
And you know what? So give us an idea, because you know, a lot of people have the idea that our ancestors were, you know, basically swinging from the trees in Africa, you know, like in a Tarzan movie, you know, maybe a little hairier, maybe a little bit more hunchbacked, but that they were, you know, sort of happy monkey-like animals that gathered bananas and ate fruit all day, and maybe, you know, occasionally got down on the ground and dug up some roots. So that are, you know, there are actually some people who claim that our ancestry is essentially vegetarian, that we were sort of like monkeys who learned to walk erect, and therefore eating animal protein is an aberration. It's not really what we were designed to do. So what's the evidence that challenges that?
Well, at the American Museum of Natural History and at the Winogrand Foundation in New York, which is an anthropological research foundation, I mean, what they shared with me is that, well, yeah, we started out as vegetarian and eating plants and maybe a little bit of what they would call animal products and whatnot, insects and that kind of thing. But
that may have been 3-5 million years ago. That's when we may have diverged from our related primate ancestors.
Right, exactly. Leslie Aiello talked about that at the Winogrand Foundation.
So not 50,000 years ago, but millions of years ago. Enough time.
Enough time for us to change
substantially.
Well, and that's just it. And see, this is one of the things that's most important is that change, from what they're telling me, is what made us into humans. You know, it was the incorporation of more and more animal foods and more, you know, all of the animal matter that were in the animals that they consumed, you know, the essential fats and the cholesterol and whatnot that allowed us to grow a brain to the capacities that we have now, that, you know, shrunk our stomach, that pushed us in the direction of becoming more and more human. So it's interesting. You know, it's very emotional subject matter for a lot of people.
Yeah. It's really ideological. I mean, there's things that I don't think anybody fights about this more than about politics. You know, it's like, what's the ideal human diet? So your title, The Perfect Human Diet, is a highly provocative title. That's a really in-your-face claim.
Well, and that's what it came down to. I mean, originally I did just the journalistic approach and called it in search of the perfect human diet, because it was modeled after some of Peter Jennings' old television specials. But when it ended up on video on demand and those kinds of things, not only could they not have that many characters, you know, online, but they said, okay, let's not be shy about it anymore. Let's just put it out there and tell folks what we found. And, you know, because this is hard science that now reveals this to us. This is no longer theory, you know, because they're able to take these animal bones and human bones and Neanderthal bones, as I like out of Jean Zoc in the south of France, and take them to the Max Planck and analyze those bones in such a way that they can tell you exactly what they ate. They can tell you whether it was a land animal or came from the sea, or whether it was fresh water or salt water. They can tell you the percentages of that based on the nitrogen values that are left within the bones, because it identifies herbivores just like it identifies carnivores. And it's finally putting the pieces of the puzzle together in a way where we can say as a fact, this is the truth. This is what we've discovered. And before that, of course, the plant materials don't survive. That's why when you dig up these sites, you get a lot of bones, but you can't really tell, you know, how much was animal product and how much was plant product. And at the time in Northern Europe, during the time of these digs, about 65,000 years ago, Mike Richards at the Max Planck said that very little plant foods is that we were essentially top-level carnivores, just like Neanderthal.
And the reason possibly being that the climate was much colder, it was the ice age, and, you know, we didn't have as much, fertile vegetation for people to subsist on. So there were these large mammals that, you know, many of them which are now extinct, that people may have consumed during that period of time.
Oh, yeah, they've even found rhinoceros bones in England, you know, so
wow.
You wouldn't the animals that you would never expect to be in that part of the world. And they did. They hunted horses and bison and bear and, you know, all of these kinds of things. And, I mean, that's part of the story, is that these are evolutionary pressures that pushed us in certain directions, whether it's the Ice Age or not, and what foods were available. That's what nature gave us, and that's what we adapted to in order to become, you know, at this point, hopefully the smartest, you know, species on the planet. At least we like to think so. And that's what made us who we are today. You know, it was the selection of those evolutionary pressures.
And so, it also may have made for increased brain power and also increased socialization, because animals that tend to require grazing or eating all day long, it's not so much of a cooperative activity. It's like everyone's out for themselves. But to hunt and track animals, that requires complex social interaction, tool making, language, and frankly, bigger brains. So there, you know, and even now food preparation, which may involve cooking and fire and the development of that technology.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was as we incorporated more and more and more of these animal products into our diet, we got smarter and faster. And as you say, this was when there was all this sudden appearance of things we now look at that express humans in art, you know, with cave art and in burying of the dead and in, you know, construction of clothes and jewelry and all those kinds of things. Those all came very late in the game. And as we became better and better at being hunters, you know, I think part of what's really fascinating about this is that this whole process and this search is that they can pin it down so specifically. And interestingly enough is they can also tell you what happened to us when we changed that, when we became primarily, you know, starch-based eaters again and moved away from what native diet, and we started to decline.
And that's an interesting story, too, because a lot of people say, look, grains are very ancient. The Egyptian empires, the dynasties of the Egyptians where they built the pyramids, this was a grain-based society. And similarly, in the Fertile Crescent, they started having the development of early wheat about 8 or 10,000 years ago, and then we were off to the races. We developed civilization. So a lot of people claim, okay, we were just sort of, you know, running around in the woods. We were cavemen. And then what facilitated civilization was the ability to domesticate animals and domesticate grains. And then that was the advent of the modern era. But you actually had discussed in The Perfect Human Diet the fact that health problems may have developed associated with the reintroduction of more plant products or starchy refined foods.
Well, yeah, according to Mike Richards, it was the combination of things. It's that first off is that that as grains replaced animal products in our diet, we declined. We dropped 4 to 6 inches in height. We got weak and brittle bones. You dig up those bones, you got rotting around the orbits of the eyes. You got dental caries showing up for the first time in the archaeological record. You know, so physically, we started to tank.
Even atherosclerosis in mummies, even. They actually find that some of the Egyptians, especially since they were nobility, they could afford honey and sugary pastries and, you know, more refined food. That was the advent of atherosclerosis.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And I think Dr. Eads mentioned to me that I think the first recorded heart attack in medical literature, if you can call it that, comes from the Egyptian period. And you may know more about that than I do. But
right. Another interesting observation is that when the Europeans came to the New World, Their first descriptions of the Native Americans were that they were extraordinarily robust. They were tall. They were muscular. At that time, the average Spanish conquistador, although he looked very heroic in their armor, was about 5'2" or 5'4", and suffered from many degenerative diseases. But this notion of the noble savage was something that they remarked on, and these were folks essentially on what's termed a Paleolithic diet.
Well, and that's right, and it's the same thing that Weston Price discovered later, much, much later, when he traveled around and discovered peoples that were still living in that same way, is that they were very robust and very healthy. And, of course, we don't know exactly what differences there would be, because some of those cultures, brought in moderate amounts of tubers or different kinds of foods that were more agriculturally oriented, but yet they still maintained incredible health. And one of the doctors said to me, he said, yes, but even they weren't as healthy as we were before agriculture. So it's kind of an interesting thing to at least muse about. But,
well, even foods that we now take for granted and that we consider healthy vegetarian foods are actually relatively new innovations. If you look at the timeline over hundreds of thousands of years or millions of years, foods like potatoes and beans. Beans are thought to be, the ultimate health food. They actually may have some properties that make them, problematic for some people. And tomatoes, for example, they were available in very small quantities in certain parts of the world. They were domesticated, and now they're ubiquitous. Same thing with corn. Corn, very, very tiny cobs of corn were first developed in South America among the Inca in the mountains there, and then they developed, good old-fashioned American corn on the cob, which is a far cry from the, the purple and, beautifully colored native species that they used to have with a lot of biodiversity.
Yeah, absolutely, and that's one of the big points also that Leslie Aiello made, was that we don't have anywhere near the variety, the biodiversity that we had in either the Paleolithic time or in the early agricultural period when you still lived in the areas that were not industrialized for their day, things that were not the major cities that you mentioned. So, it's fascinating. I mean, and also clustering together may have helped us develop different kinds of aspects that we're glad we have as far as socialization or education or those kinds of things. But there was a price, and, including other disease states that were not nutritionally oriented, but were because of passing bugs amongst ourselves.
Right, sanitation, crowding, and so on.
Right, exactly. So it was kind of a double whammy there.
So a price that we pay for civilization. So what's the answer? I mean, do we go back to, consuming, wild antelope and rhinoceros meat and, digging in the ground for termites, like people did, 500,000 years ago? Would that be the right approach for restoring our health?
Well, perhaps like this dig in the south of France, they weren't still eating termites like they were back then, because from what I understand is they didn't even eat much in the way of fowl. They much preferred large game animals. Hmm.
So this kind of gives the lie to the people who say, look, my patients often say to me, I don't eat much red meat, as if that's like the hallmark of dietary superiority. They eat fish, they eat poultry because it's, quote, lighter meat. And what you're saying is these people were, our very ancient ancestors were going full hog on red meat.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And then the difference between us and the Neanderthal was the addition of fish. It was never the exclusion of big game animals to eat fish. It's just that it expanded our biodiversity, what was available to us, our food diversity there. I think that the lesson here in our modern times is we finally have progressed enough technologically that we can look to this time when we were bigger, stronger, healthier, and say, well, wait a second, we really ought to take this very seriously because our bodies still are looking for these same nutritional factors in order to have optimal health, and bring into question some of the things that we've been doing that obviously are not working. part of my hope of a film such as this is A, that it brings hope to people that don't have hope because, you know, they haven't had the full breadth of information, but that it would also elevate the public conversation and say, wait a second, we're very predisposed in this country to thinking that we ought to be plant eaters. But it's not based on hard science. It's based on emotional, you know, content more than anything. And I can't fault anybody for wanting to be compassionate or anything like that, but we also have to be realistic. And, in fact, Dr. Sebring told me less than a month ago that his sickest patients are his vegetarians that come in. So
that is not uncommonly my experience, unfortunately, because if you don't do it right or if it's not suited to your genetics, it can be pretty problematic. So one concern, though, is, you know, some people, and I think, there was a mixed message with my good colleague, Dr. Robert Adkins, right here in New York City, is he advocated a diet that was high in meat and protein and fat. And so some people living high on the hog on the Upper East Side of New York said, great, I'll just order the bacon cheeseburger and throw away the bun and eat some lettuce leaves without dressing, and I'll be on the Atkins diet. Does that really work, you know, when we're talking about modern sources of fat and meat?
Well, like Dr. Sebring said, who has a practice where he works with people, you know, one-on-one, and in fact, he was the first U.S. Evolutionary nutrition doctor to, as far as I can tell, and from what Dr.
He puts people on a Paleolithic diet.
He does. He uses Lauren's book, and then he works with them for supplementation depending on their personal needs and that kind of thing. And has had great success in helping turn people around. Of course, now I've forgotten what we were asking just before that. But
I guess what I'm getting to is, you know, I have a little saying.
Oh, the meat.
It's not you are what you eat. It's you are what you eat eats sometimes, because modern meat is problematic from a variety of standpoints. So actually, vegetarians may escape some of the harms associated with modern livestock and animal husbandry.
Well, that's true. And when people first change over, if they get away from a standard American diet, they may actually get a little healthier for a while. It's the long-term ramifications of not having the nutrition that the body is looking for that start impacting you once you get over that initial hurdle of getting away from pesticides and fungicides and everything else that's commonly used on our food sources. The way Dr. Sebring talks about it is he says that, you know, you should start every meal with protein, but ideally from an animal who was eating what they were supposed to eat. So I think that really speaks to your point, is that, you know, if you can get it, if you can afford it, you know, it's always better to get wild, you know, animal foods and wild plant foods to the best of your ability. That said, why in the film we go into a regular supermarket is that most people don't have that. You know, most people can't order up from U.S. Wellness Meats. You know, they more people are on a budget than not. And so there are ways you can shop in the regular supermarket, I think, is also part of it, the story here. And you can be selective, and you can get whole cuts of meat and not buy, you know, don't make yourself crazy eating a lot of bacon and processed meats, that you use whole cuts of meats. You know, you can trim the fat there if it's commercial meat and it's not organic, so you can get rid of some of the artifacts that would be in there from modern food processing and animal husbandry that we do here in commercial farming. And then you can supplement to the best of your ability, and it's pretty reasonable to get now with a little bit of fish oil and those kinds of things to try to help bring it back to more of the kind of balance that it would be if you were able to get wild animals. You know, so it helps give us a template and helps show us the light at the end of the tunnel. And then depending on our own personal circumstances, you know, we can incorporate that and help improve our health.
Well, give us a sense of, you know, what do you eat personally? What do you have for breakfast this morning, for example?
Oh, it's kind of funny. I was sitting down at lunch years ago with Dr. Eads long before this, and he was saying, you know, myself and a what's Ray Audette, who wrote a book called Neanderthin many years ago. He said,
"Yeah, I remember that book."
Says you're the only two people I know that do this 100%. So it's just in my nature to figure, well, if I'm going to try to get the benefits of something, that I should really give it my all. So I don't wander. You know, I eat as much, you know, whole foods, and I get, as you know, the best quality that I can afford, and it's not always organic. So I, you know, I do the same kind of thing and trim it and supplement with Carlson's fish oil in my particular case.
Mm-hmm.
But for breakfast this morning, I had some scrambled eggs, because that was
okay.
That's
complete
what I had
protein
handy,
mm-hmm.
with a little bit of Kerrygold grass-fed butter.
There you go.
And then I have a little Carlson fish oil chaser after that, and I was dashing out the door. So that's actually all I had.
Actually, you had a very low carbohydrate breakfast there, you know, which is unusual. A lot of people really they need the grains, the porridge, the oatmeal. You know, even on a healthy breakfast program, they're going for lots of carbs.
Yeah, and you know, when I was first learning to shift over and let go of grains and things like that, I think that's just an adaptation process. And also, if you try to do it low fat, you're going to get yourself into trouble, because like any low fat diet, you're going to be hungry all the time.
Right, right. So you need the healthy fats.
Absolutely. And I think that makes a huge difference. And the longer I've been on this, the more well adapted I am to it. And, it's very satisfying. For myself, because I never did great with sugar, mm-hmm. and too much sugar, is that if I eat fruits, I eat just a little bit as a dessert after I've had mostly dinner is usually the only time that I have some, like some, you know, some organic strawberries. Organic,
but you're not going to have a quarter of a watermelon or something like that. You're not going to have tons of sugar.
No, not anymore. When I was a raw food vegan, I ate half a watermelon once, but that was it.
Right.
No more.
And have you noticed, have you accrued any health benefits to your knowledge? Do you find that you feel any different? Do you feel lighter? Do you feel better focus? Or have you managed to trim excess weight? Or, you know, how's it working out for you?
Well, I think part of what's interesting is because of my heart defect and that part of my health has declined. You know, it's gotten worse as I've gotten older.
But that's it's a genetic condition. Let's emphasize
right.
that. And by the way, you know, just for our listening audience, you know, the condition that CJ has, he didn't have the kind of heart attack that people get in advanced age because their arteries are clogged. This is due to a conduction defect in the heart that's caused by, you know, the muscle amping up for genetic reasons. So it's not really, I don't think it's the type of heart disease that's amenable to a nutritional fix, although you want to be in the best possible diet, because if you weren't, you know, your survival chances would be diminished.
Right, exactly. And that's where I was headed with that, is that, you know, you're right. There's nothing I can do about the genetic one except try to keep myself as healthy as possible, and hopefully that will help ward off some of that particular decline. But what I have noticed is that even though I can't exercise very much as I've gotten older, it's like I have trouble getting upstairs some days, and because I also have an exercise-induced obstruction, that means the harder I work out, the less oxygen I get as part of this heart issue, is that I've remained lean. You know, I haven't gotten fat and portly, and it's just all worked out very well as far as that's concerned. I mean, my blood values are all perfectly normal, you know. In fact, a few years ago when I first...
Even with, you know, eggs and butter for breakfast.
Oh, yeah. I don't think, without exaggeration, I would have to say I eat 40-50% of my diet as fat. You know, I don't think that's an exaggeration. And, you know, and then protein. And then I eat, as, you know, fresh vegetables and, you know, organic whenever possible. And, you know, a little bit of organic stir-fried vegetables and things like that. But, yes, I think that I, you know, I'm very pleased with what I can test. And I'm also old enough, too, now to know that, you know, I wish I was 24 again and I could still race dirt bikes and do all that super athletic kind of CrossFit world now, where you know, everyone looks like Roman athletes, but I'm not at that stage.
Especially the kids these days, because they're all pumping iron.
Oh, yeah. That's the name of the game now. Everybody wants a six-pack.
Yep.
But But yeah, I think it was the right choice. And since I'm not eating grains and stuff anymore, I'm not as hungry and I'm not as chubby and I'm not as, any of the things that might develop if I kept eating those over time. So yeah, I'm really pleased with it. I think it works really well.
Great. All right. So we've been remiss because we haven't given our listeners the heads up on how to get a hold of The Perfect Human Diet. It's a DVD and a variety of ways to order it. I listened to it on iTunes. Is it still available via iTunes?
Yes, it's on iTunes and it's also on Amazon, both as the DVD and as electronic stream, just like on iTunes. It's on iTunes. It's available in over 40 countries and with 5 languages. The DVD at this point is just English. And so it's widely available. It may still be on your cable system because they put on for a while and then they take it off. So if you search by name, it might be there. But yes, it's going to be on iTunes for a number of years.
Yeah, it's a real sensation. And, you know, it's very viral. It's a lot of people are looking at it. Is there a Facebook, site for it as well? Or there's certainly a website, right? There's perfecthumandiet.us.
Yeah, you can do .com or .us. It'll roll to the same place.
And it's the number one top-selling documentary, the number one top-selling independent film, and it's among the top 10 movies on iTunes in that genre as a documentary.
Right. Well, yeah, in January, those are the numbers we hit, and then, of course, they go up and down all the time after that, especially after the Oscars are nominated. But yes, it's legacy film now, and these things go up and down depending on what's going on in public awareness and in the news, and as they seek it out, or people such as yourself, and people hear your podcast, and it's likely to get a little bump.
Well, we hope to give it some impetus because whatever your dietary proclivities are, have an open mind, take a look at The Perfect Human Diet because it's got a lot of science and it's got some great experts. And it's a great investigation of the true origins of the human diet and what our physiology has adapted to over the literally not thousands of years, but millions of years of human evolution. I congratulate you. You've done a great job, CJ, in putting together all this important information.
Well, thanks so much. It was a great adventure, and now it's taking on some legs and becoming another kind of adventure. So it's wonderful to share it, and I'm so glad that you wanted to share it with your audience.
Okay, it's The Perfect Human Diet, and the website is perfecthumandiet.com. Thanks very much, CJ Hunt, for joining us for the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.
Thanks so much, Doctor. I appreciate it.
I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Thanks for joining us. All right, let me just